The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth. As we approach the end of summer, many Americans are thinking about the coming school year. Today, I'm here with IJ Senior Attorney Tim Keller and a special guest, Corey DeAngelis of the Reason Foundation. We're going to talk about the disruptions we've already seen in education in 2020 and about what might be coming. Corey, let's start by talking about this past spring. It was rough for many people, and I think that a lot of families had their own experiences about what worked and what didn't work. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit more broadly about what we've seen as the consequences to students from the widespread school closures and other disruptions that already have happened as a result of the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that it differs by individual family unit, which I'll get into. And the result of that is that we should fund families directly and fund students so that each individual family can choose the educational environment that works best for them. The reality is, for far too many families during the spring, it was a total disaster, this virtual education from home provided by the government-run school districts. They just, you know, far too many of them just could not make it work in the short amount of time. And that doesn't mean that they're, you know, incompetent, doesn't mean that they weren't trying hard. It was just a last minute thing. They hadn't been doing this for a long time. It's a new, learning environment for them that far too many didn't do a good job. And you can also argue that some school districts didn't have a good incentive or a particularly strong incentive to get it right either, because their customers couldn't take their money elsewhere if there was not a school choice program in place in their location. The Center for Reinventing Public Education, for example, found that one in every three school districts did not require teachers to, only one in three school districts even required teachers to provide virtual instruction to their students each day, and less than half of the school districts required the teachers to even take attendance for their students regularly. So we saw a mix. You know, some school districts did a good job, and then others just did not. Looking at the data from CERPE and other reports in Wall Street Journal and other locations. But then there's on the flip side, a lot of families figured out that virtual learning could work for them, and particularly if they just took the leap into homeschooling, a lot of families found that that could work for their individual situations. And we've seen across a lot of different states a huge uptick in homeschooling favorability. For example, EdChoice put out a poll in April, a nationally representative survey that found that as a result of COVID-19, families in general had 52% of them had a more favorable view of homeschooling as a result of COVID-19. And only about 26% said that they had a less favorable view. And they continued doing that polling each month, finding similar trajectories. And then also in July, they found a huge uptick from that baseline in homeschooling favorability as well. So we're seeing differences, and it depends on the individual family situation and what that means. And the best policy to make that to adjust to the, you know, to all the needs of the individual families is to allow the funding to follow the student so that each family can figure out what works best for them.
For probably a lot of families, this spring was really the first time that they had to do that, you know, because there's definitely the idea that, well, it's the job of the public school and you kind of trust them to, you know, you put your kid in and you kind of trust them to take it from there. And that wasn't an option this summer and this past spring. So they're kind of learning as they go. Meanwhile, the reaction of the teachers' unions to families kind of trying to figure it out on their own and making different choices and pursuing different paths has been really remarkable. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen? You've monitored this all over the country. What kinds of trends you're seeing in terms of the behavior of the unions?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of different things going on with the teachers' unions over the past couple of months. And they're not just trying to prevent families from having new additional options when it comes to, you know, private school choice initiatives or expanded charter school access. They're fighting they have been fighting over the past couple of months to prevent families from having options that they would have otherwise already had before all this mess started. And they've come out and explicitly said that it's because they want to prevent their schools from losing money. We don't even have to guess as to why they're fighting against families switching to charter schools, for example. But this all started, you know, a couple months ago in states like Oregon. Wall Street Journal reported that the Oregon Teachers Union actually lobbied to make it illegal to enroll your children into enroll additional children into virtual schools. The Wall Street Journal reported just from one virtual school in the state, 1,600 students were blocked from switching to a virtual school that would have otherwise been okay. Just imagine if during the pandemic, you know, when the lockdowns all started, if dine-in only restaurants started to lobby to the government to prevent families from being able to access restaurants that delivered food to your house. That would be seen as opportunistic and a negative thing to do to prevent families in need from having food options. Similarly, this seems really opportunistic in the sense in Oregon of blocking families from having virtual education options in the time that they need them more than ever. We saw other states doing it as well. Pennsylvania Association of School Administrators admitted that they lobbied to the government in order to do something similar. They wanted to make it illegal to switch to virtual charter schools, which have been serving children adequately from afar for years and years. They lobbied to prevent that from happening. They didn't get everything that they wanted, but they did get the next best thing. They prevented the dollars. So in Pennsylvania, it's technically legal to enroll your child in a virtual charter school, but the dollars won't follow the child to that virtual school. So they essentially froze enrollments and blocked the funding, which California followed shortly after Pennsylvania. And so you had special interests supporting a policy to block funding from following the child to charter schools in California. That has real life impacts, right? One charter school in general in California already reported that they had to put 500 already enrolled students back onto the wait list. And now you have families, and that's because they you know, originally would have gotten the funding for those students. They would have been able to cover the cost associated with educating those students. But when the legislature passed the bill to block the funding from following the student, they no longer had the money to be able to hire the teachers needed to educate those students. So they had to put those kids back on the wait list. Now we have families in California actually filed a lawsuit against the state from blocking them from having that access to educational opportunity in California. We're seeing just tons of theatrics from unions all across the United States. We're seeing in Arizona, they're instructing their members to write obituaries to the governor. We saw 10 unions from big cities, from Boston to Milwaukee to Little Rock and to other cities, link up with the Democratic Socialists of America, and they've actually called for banning, and so they're making it all about demanding safe schools. That's kind of their slogan, to demand safe schools. And they had a national day of resistance last Monday, and they called for a lot of different things. And one was, you know, a massive infusion in federal money. So they wanted a lot more money than we're already spending, because, you know, more money will make your school safer, is their argument. And that you can kind of see a connection there. But then they threw in all this other stuff that seems pretty unrelated to safety. They wanted to ban new charter schools, ban new private school choice initiatives, ban standardized testing. So to get rid of all types of accountability from the bottom from the top down to the bottom up. And if you're really thinking about the safety of children, wouldn't you want more square footage and more options for families so that they could spread out in different locations? That tells you it's about power, not so much about safety of children, because if you're really about the safety of children, you would be all for allowing them to access other locations like charter schools and private schools. And so they also called for police-free schools. And we saw unions, for example, in Los Angeles. They were probably the first one to call for this. They called for defunding the police in order to reopen the schools. So it looks, it turned into a pretty big power grab, and it started to look a lot like just throwing in whatever political stuff you wanted to get into this and make that part of the reopening plans. And I want to say this is really about power here, because We're not seeing this in any other industry. We're not seeing this from the private school sector either. We're not seeing this with daycares. We're not seeing this with grocery stores. And I think the difference is because with the public school system, they get your money regardless. So they have a very strong incentive, not to say that anybody has ill motives. They just have a different incentive structure set up to where if they don't reopen in person, they still get your money regardless. If Walmart doesn't reopen in person, for example, if they didn't do that, it would be kind of inconvenient for me, but it wouldn't be devastating because I could take my money to Trader Joe's or Whole Foods or Safeway. And Walmart has a strong incentive to reopen in a safe manner as well because they don't want to get their customers sick or their employees sick. So they have an incentive to get it right. And they have an additional incentive because you can take your money elsewhere. And similarly, in the school system, if the schools don't reopen, I should be able to take my child's education dollars elsewhere to another location. And even if that's a micro school or a pandemic pod, which I think we'll get into in a little later. But I think that's the difference, that there's a very different incentive structure set up. And we've even seen places like Montgomery County, Maryland. There was a bunch of back and forth with the health commissioner calling to make it illegal to open the private schools as well, even though daycares were allowed to reopen. And they ended up picking the date to be October 1st to prevent families from switching to private schools until October 1st. And it just so happened that the day before that, September 30th, was the enrollment deadline for the public schools in Montgomery County.
That's when they get their money, right?
What their funding is based on the enrollment counts. And Walter Olson at the Cato Institute pointed out in a blog post recently on the Cato website that the enrollments were actually much lower than projected in the public school system in Montgomery County. And they had just reported that maybe a week before that the decision to shutter the private schools as well. The governor came down and said, no, you can't have blanket school closures. Then the health commissioner came back, or the health official came back and said, oh, we're going to close them anyway. And then finally, after this back and forth for a couple weeks, the health official finally backed off and rescinded his order to close the private schools too. And look, I can go on the entire hour of examples of stuff like this happening, but look, there's so many examples of special interests trying to prevent the schools from reopening and trying to prevent families from having other options too. And then and I have to just say real quick that they're also not just calling for remote only learning. You have some unions calling to reduce the amount of hours required to work. So you saw when this all started in Los Angeles, the United Teachers Los Angeles struck a deal with the district to only require 4 hours of instruction by the teachers each day. And that wasn't only instruction, that could be just grading papers and other activities. You could have just chose to do your 4 hours of grading papers if you wanted in that deal. And then now you see unions like the union boss in Miami just reported in the New York Times that now, you know, we have teachers that are concerned about what their backgrounds will look like during their Zoom instruction. So we don't know if we want to, you know, require our teachers to do that as either, because they might, you know, not have a clean place behind them, or they're just feeling anxious about how they look on camera. And so it just seems like, you know, the unions are just, first, we don't want it to do any in person. So then the districts are coming back saying, okay, well, we'll have the kids stay home. This happened in Los Angeles. We'll have the kids stay home and you can go back and report to the classroom each day. Social distancing isn't a problem there. The students are at home. And then they said, oh, no, that's not fair. You can't require them to come in person. So we're going to have them teach from home. And now you have other unions saying, oh, well, if you require us to do that, that's a problem too. And I think, look, I mean, I'm okay with teachers. Oh, and then you also have teachers threatening strikes too. The American Federation for Teachers president, Randy Weingarten, just said that they're approved that their 1.7 million members is the second largest teachers union in the United States. They're threatening safety strikes now as well. If you don't do the things that we ask you, we're going to go on strike. And look, I don't have a problem with unions organizing and teachers organizing and protesting with having their members write fake obituaries if they want to do that. I think it's kind of a little much, but if they want to do that, that's whatever. You know, if that's how you want to express yourself, you should be able to do that. But at the same time, you shouldn't be able to force families to pay for schools that are closed and to force families to pay for people who are not showing up to work each day. That decision needs to be in the hands of the families.
Well, it sounds like they're using a lot of political methods. And Tim, you've experienced some of the legal methods as well, you know, to kind of get exactly to what Corey is saying about limiting the exit options for families, even options that previously had existed. Can you talk about what we're seeing on the legal front?
No, that's exactly right. We're not only seeing political power being wielded, we are also seeing lawsuits being filed to eliminate existing educational choice options for parents, especially as parents are seeking to leave public schools that aren't currently serving their kids and to access options that'll give their kids an opportunity to either access quality virtual instruction or actual in-person in-classroom instruction this fall. In the state of North Carolina, there's an opportunity scholarship program which provides low-income families up to $4,200 per child to attend the private school of their choice. That program currently serves over 12,000 students, and it looks like it could serve as many as 15,000 this fall based on new applications and the cap that it currently exists on that program. And yet, just a couple of weeks ago, we saw a lawsuit that was filed challenging the constitutionality of that program, despite the fact that the program was upheld by the North Carolina State Supreme Court in 2015. And this brand new lawsuit is basically just recycling all of the same arguments that were made in that suit in an effort to eliminate those options for parents. We see school districts in Ohio are rattling their sabers, threatening to challenge school choice programs in that state that are currently serving tens of thousands of students. And this is basically replaying itself over and over and over again all across the country right now as new lawsuits are being filed and as new lawsuits are being threatened.
So what are the, you said that they're recycling the arguments from 2015. What exactly are they arguing? Like how meritorious are their claims?
So they're not meritorious at all. The primary talking point they've been making in the quote-unquote court of public opinion is that this program subjects citizens to religious discrimination because they may not have a private school near them that they want to attend. They've lined up parents and teachers to be the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, and they're saying, hey, if I wanted to apply for the program and obtain a scholarship, I may not want to send my kid to a nearby religious school. That ignores a couple of things. Number one, it ignores the fact that these school choice programs can empower parents to organize themselves, create new schools, new opportunities, to pursue those opportunities through just all sorts of educational entrepreneurship options. So it ignores the fact that we can create new educational options. But it also suggests that other programs might be unconstitutional just because we were talking before we started recording about Pell Grants, and would the federal constitutional Pell Grant program be unconstitutional just because there might be only religious educational options near my house? No, of course not, because what the program does in North Carolina is it expands educational opportunities for parents, and of course, no parent is required to apply for that program to accept a scholarship and to pursue it. They can pursue all sorts of other educational options alongside the Opportunity Scholarship Program.
So, Corey, you talked earlier about, you know, you've said a couple of times, you say it on Twitter a lot. It's one of my favorite things that that you point out over and over and over again is that we should be funding students, not systems. And so, I mean, there's obviously a lot of reasons to be dissatisfied right now with what's going on. But if we look kind of to what the future could look like if we took that approach, what kinds of options do you see maybe coming down the pipe? You know, Tim mentioned the idea of education entrepreneurship. What are the things that are kind of happening naturally or spontaneously right now? What other things could be coming if people did and the states did fund students as opposed to systems?
Yeah, I just want to point out with that fight going on in North Carolina right now, this program serves, I just talked to Terry Stoops from John Locke Foundation, who's based in North Carolina, a think tank out there. The average household income of students using that program is only around $30,000 in North Carolina. So when Tim says low income, he means low income, that the two teachers groups out there are launching an attack on low-income families. And then they have the audacity to take it a step further. The president of the largest teachers union in the United States, the National Education Association, which also happens to be the largest labor union period in the United States, actually commented on this lawsuit. And she actually had the audacity to say, and the quote is something along the lines of, private schools are unaccountable to parents. And it's like, come on, they're directly accountable to parents. If they're not, the parents can take their money elsewhere. And this, it's kind of amazing that they're implying that the low-income families are choosing schools that aren't working for them or that are working less well for them than the traditional public school system. So I just want to respond to Lily's absurd claims that private schools are unaccountable to families that are voluntarily choosing them.
Well, and North Carolina parents are speaking up, Corey. There was one parent named Charlonda Brown who spoke up in response to that and said, it's absurd to say that private schools are not accountable because they are accountable to me. She's a scholarship recipient. She's got two of her kids in two different private schools, one in a private religious school, one in a private Montessori school. And she's like, that is absurd. They are accountable directly to me. And that's exactly right.
Yeah, and Tim, you're totally right that the constitutional argument is horrible here. And I just want to reiterate, if you don't have a religious or if you only have religious private colleges nearby you, that doesn't mean that Pell Grants discriminate on the basis of religion. Obviously, this North Carolina program does not discriminate on the basis of religion. Whatever your religious background is, you can apply for the scholarship, and the state isn't going to say you're not religious, you can't have it, or you are religious, you can't have it. So it doesn't discriminate on the basis of religion. And what's interesting here is the Espinoza case just came out favorably in favor of families and school choice recently that said that if you're going to have a private school choice program, you cannot prevent religious schools from participating. And this seems like this fight in North Carolina is, essentially pushing to nix a program because religious schools are participating. So it seems like there would be do you think that would go to the Supreme Court again based on the Espinoza ruling if they were to be successful in nixing the program?
Well, if the North Carolina Supreme Court were to strike down the program simply because religious schools were eligible to participate, it would have to go back to the Supreme Court, and it would be a clear violation of Espinoza. And let's be clear about that point too, because even though their primary arguments are that families can enroll in religious schools, they're not just asking that the religious schools be excluded because they can't under Espinoza. That's why they're asking for the entire program to be struck down. They are trying to take away options for every low-income family in North Carolina, not just religious options.
And which is what happened in Montana, right? They nixed the whole program. And okay, so I just want to point out real quick on North Carolina before I get to the response on funding students instead of systems, because I kind of took it off the rail a little bit. But look, there's only one peer-reviewed study on the North Carolina Opportunity Scholarship Program. It was done by North Carolina State University's Anna Egalite and her team over there. And they did the most rigorous study on the topic, peer-reviewed in AERA Open, an academic journal. And they found large positive effects of accessing that program on academic outcomes. And so it wasn't a random assignment study, but it's the next best thing. And they used a pretty good matching procedure. So to say that the program isn't unaccountable to students flies in the face of, one, the evidence, and then basic logic that families aren't going to choose schools that aren't accountable to them. And so that's another quick response. But yes, Melanie, my main argument is to fund the students instead of the systems. And I always like to point out that that's how we do it with a whole host of other taxpayer-funded initiatives. We've already talked about the Pell Grants for higher education, right? We give the money to the individual student. The student can pick a public university or a private university that works for them. They're not residentially assigned to use that. You're not forced to use the Pell Grant funding at your nearest community college, for example. And pre-K programs as well. The pre-K funding goes to the individual family, and the family can pick a public or private provider of the pre-K program. So why is it any different? Why are certain groups coming out against what happens between those two time periods? Why is it okay for pre-K programs to fund the students and not the system? Why is it okay for Pell Grants to fund the students and not the system? And then why all of a sudden do you have the same people who support these two programs oppose the K-12 voucher program, which funds the students in the same way and allows students to pick. I think it's because of the difference in power dynamics. In the K-12 education system, you have a entrenched monopoly that gets your money no matter what. In the higher education system and in the pre-K system, the default is that we're already having people and they're already allowed to take their money to the provider of their choosing. And because in the K-12 world, you have an entrenched interest of not allowing you to do so, that's why we're seeing differences in people supporting one and not the other, because there's no logically consistent argument to make to be for one, not the other, until you realize these power dynamics. So I think that's the difference. And then it's not just limited to education. We have food stamps. The food stamp goes to the individual. The individual can pick a public, they can pick different grocery stores of their choosing. You can pick Walmart, Trader Joe's, Whole Foods. The difference is the choice is in the hands of the consumer. Everybody would think it would be totally absurd, and rightly so, to say if you're a low-income family, you must be residentially assigned to a government-run grocery store if you want to use your taxpayer-funded program in order to get groceries for your family. People would think that would be a restriction on those individuals' liberties, and rightly so. In the current system, people can pick Walmart, Trader Joe's, and where to best allocate their resources for their families. And I can go on and on with these examples from Medicare, Section 8 housing. The funding goes to people. It doesn't go to an institution. We should do the same thing with K-12 education. And look, there's a lot of stuff going on right now that I see as being the future of education. And you mentioned spontaneous order. This is a very excellent lesson in spontaneous or emergent order, something that Austrian economists like to talk about a lot. When the government doesn't provide something adequately, individuals in society will come together and provide solutions to a problem that they see in front of them. And the problem that you see right now is that the public school system, what I tend to refer to as the government-run school system, because these are schools run by local governments and funded by governments and regulated by governments and compelled by governments, is that they're saying that they're not going to reopen. We see the strikes happening. We see threats of strikes. We see protests. We see teachers' unions in Milwaukee, which I forgot to mention earlier, actually creating fake tombstones to protest reopening the school. So very morbid protests. And we're just seeing people not wanting to return to the classroom. And one, I think it's because of the incentive structure. And these people may be actually fearful, but look, you should have the choice to not return to work, but I should also have the choice to take my children's education dollars elsewhere. So everybody should have a choice, not just particular groups. And
can we talk a little bit about like how a system could actually, like, I want to, maybe it would be interesting, I think, for people who aren't as well versed in sort of the options. It's very obvious to people that private schools are an option. But you know, Tim, in Arizona, you were working to, one of the things that you did years ago in Arizona was help create a program there that expanded or that sought to expand options beyond just simply using these dollars following the students to a private school. Can you talk about that? And then I'd like to kind of think about how a system like that could work, you know, to do exactly what Corey is saying.
Yeah, right. I mean, these are not just binary options. It's not just we're not talking about just public schools versus private schools. We're talking about, you know, as Corey was saying, spontaneous order. We're talking about new educational options that are emerging right before our eyes right now, but that were also beginning to emerge even before the pandemic began in March. So the program that you're talking about that I helped design was Arizona's Education Savings Account Program. Actually, in Arizona, we called it an Empowerment Scholarship Account. But nationally and within the movement, we call them education savings accounts. And what the program in Arizona does is, for eligible families, it allocates 90% of what the state would have spent on their student in their residentially assigned government school and places it into a parent-controlled account, which allows parents to use those dollars to educate their kids in any variety of manner that they so desire. So parents who are enrolled in the ESA program don't have to enroll their kids in a public school. They don't have to enroll their kids in a private school. They can instead use those dollars to individually tailor and design an education for their student that's going to meet their needs. And it can be through a variety of options. And so as with that program in place, even a year ago, what we saw was a new type of education begin to emerge. And one of the examples of that is Prenda. I guess we would call Prenda a micro school, but it's so much more than that. So with Prenda, what we've seen is them open small brick and mortar schools in storefronts, serving a small number of kids using a variety of both in-person and virtual instruction. But those same sort of micro schools are also operating through Prenda in homes as well as in brick and mortar storefronts. So you've
got incredibly timely right now.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
The micro school thing.
And parents are able to use their ESA dollars to pay the tuition, the educational costs at Prenda. So they've got options for parents who need in-person instruction offsite. They've developed opportunities for in-person instruction in small groups in homes. They've also partnered with charter schools to provide their options both in homes and outside of the homes. So and now of course there's a ton of interest in this type of model occurring all over the country. And at the same time that parents are starting to organize and figuring out, okay, how can we provide our kids with an instruction and feeling very confident that in fact they can provide that instruction opportunity. We even see school districts pushing back from that. There was a letter sent to parents from Fairfax County saying, hey, we are hearing that you are organizing yourself into these pods and you're starting to reach out to us for maybe some assistance in doing that. And we want to tell you, we think this is a terrible idea. We don't think this is an equitable way to provide kids instruction and we're actually discouraging you from doing it. We recognize that we might be able to stop you, but we're going to discourage you from doing it, which to me is just unconscionable and absolutely shocking, especially when it's occurring in those places, even without the assistance of an Arizona-style ESA program.
I did actually want to talk about that a little bit, because that equity question is a real concern, the idea that, well, if you have the money and the resources, you can just do whatever. You know, you can do whatever you want, you can make it work. And then we're just leaving behind all of these other families who don't have the option to quit their job and stay home and homeschool, or who don't have the money to hire a tutor. And so, you know, if that is a real concern, how do you respond to that again in this model? How can you assure that those students are provided for?
Yeah, well, I should actually let Corey answer this question, because I heard him answer it in a separate interview yesterday, which is that it's true that parents with more resources have more options, and there is some inequities in the system. But the answer, the solution, is what we've been saying in this podcast: fund students, not systems.
Yeah. So building off of what Tim said, I saw a lot of outlets such as the Washington Post and New York Times. And if you just go to a Google search and type in the two words pandemic pods, it seems like every single article that pops up talks about inequities resulting from pandemic pods and how somehow, you know, families searching for educational options right now when the government school system isn't providing them is somehow a bad thing. It's a lot of negative articles, except for one that I saw by Matthew Ladner and Jason Bedrick in the Washington Examiner. They're the only people who have identified the obvious solution to fund the students directly so that less advantaged families can have these options as well. It's true that several hundreds and thousands of families are actually getting together and forming these pandemic pods. You look at one group in particular in the Bay Area, it's called Pandemic Pods Maine. If you look on Facebook, M-A-I-N, 35,000 families have already gotten together, at least from the last time that I've checked, in the last couple of weeks, in this group to spontaneously form these groups to find solutions for their children. So for their children, they're finding a solution to this problem right now. And it's true that this could lead to inequities in the current system, but the obvious solution is to fix the funding mechanism, to have the dollars go to the individual students so that less advantaged families can afford these solutions as well. And so I think that's the obvious solution here that a lot of outlets are just willfully ignoring or just haven't thought about yet.
Well, it sounds like it's definitely not coming up in the media. Are you hearing from any lawmakers? I know that Tim at IJ spends a lot of time counseling legislators who want to introduce a little bit more choice or who want to address problems like this. Have either of you heard of policymakers or lawmakers trying to grapple with this issue in a way that, you know, is along the lines of what you're suggesting could solve it?
Yeah, there's a lot of states that have already taken action, and there's other states that are trying to plan how to fund students instead of systems. So three states in particular, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, and South Carolina, already have plans in place to take existing federal CARES Act dollars that are sitting in their state accounts to allocate some of those dollars, not all of them, but a certain percentage, to students directly so that they can use them either in a voucher form for private school tuition and fees or in an education savings account form so that families can access these pandemic pods or micro schools or even use it to offset the cost of online learning even in the public school system. So that's some states, but then also there's legislators in Pennsylvania. They propose something called Back on Track Education Savings Accounts. And they're pushing to similarly take some of those existing CARES Act fund dollars and to allocate it to students in the form of an education savings account. And I think this would be for 500,000 different families and students in Pennsylvania. And I think it's around $1,000 per child, which, it could go a long way towards offsetting the cost of homeschooling or private school tuition. And it's a step in the right direction, even though it's not 100% of the funding that the child should get. In Pennsylvania, for example, they spend $19,000 per child per year in the public school system. Why not allow, 90 or 80% of that funding to go to the student to offset the fees at a private school? Private school tuition in Pennsylvania is only around $11,000 per child. So that funding can go a long way towards offsetting those costs. And so that's, a couple of the states that I've seen. And then also at the federal level, I've seen three different bills introduced in the past couple of weeks to fund students directly using existing federal education dollars. Most prominently that I've talked about is Rand Paul, U.S. Senator from Kentucky, has introduced the biggest legislation that I've seen out of the three bills to fund the students directly. And his plan is to take nearly all existing federal education dollars from that are already being spent in the public school system and to give families the choice to take their federal education dollars to a private school of their choosing. So this would be huge. I mean, we spend $70 billion per year in the public education system through federal sources. It's only 8% of the total, but that is a step in the right direction in funding the students instead of the systems. Other senators, such as Congress people such as Lamar Alexander and Tim Scott, have called for the School Choice Now Act, which is a similar proposal, and it's two parts. One is to take 10% of existing of the money that's going to be allocated through the stimulus bill and have that go to private schools. Originally, when it was introduced, it was to go directly to families, which would have been a better solution, in my opinion. But they also have worked in the Education Freedom Scholarship proposal to have $5 billion per year in tax credit scholarships go directly to families, which could be another way to fund families instead of systems. And then lastly, most recently, Ted Cruz has introduced federal legislation to fund students directly, but his is a little different, and I don't think it's using existing dollars. I have to read it more clearly, but I think Cruz's proposal is an additional expenditure in addition to what we're already spending in federal education. So, for that reason, I prefer the Rand proposal.
So we've talked about a lot of reasons to be kind of outraged, and people are probably kind of anxious. Little glimmers of hope, but maybe feels a little bit far into the future to really get to the place of an educational marketplace or where we really are funding the students in the way that you describe. To close things out, I wondered if either of you or both of you could just give a few thoughts on reasons that families should have for optimism right now, because it is an anxious time for all Americans for a number of reasons, and especially, as I mentioned at the start, for those looking ahead to the school year. Any words of optimism or encouragement that you have for those families?
Yeah, I would say, go ahead, Tim.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, I think there is a lot of reason for optimism right now. I mean, we're not going to see solutions take root tomorrow and provide opportunities for every single family tomorrow to fund them instead of funding the existing school system. But I think parents are discovering a lot of things about the existing public school system that they didn't know before. They're discovering that the system was very stressful for their students, and that students actually enjoy learning at home in a different manner than they were learning before there. And I'm a homeschool parent myself, and one of the most common things we would hear when we were talking to parents was, I could never do that. I could never homeschool my child. And what they're discovering now is, oh, I can homeschool my child, or I can direct my child's education by partnering with other families, outsourcing instruction, as Corey mentioned, coming together through just networks of parents on Facebook, Twitter, other social media connections that you've got with other friends, and that we actually can do a good job of providing our kids with a high quality education. Parents are discovering that right now, and I think that's a tremendous source of optimism as we head into, I think, what will be a bold and brave new future for education in America.
Yeah, I totally agree. Families are already doing it, even though we don't currently fund students instead of systems in the current education system. Families are seeing right now that the public school system is not serving them in an adequate manner. And people are really reevaluating the factory model of education that I would argue has been outdated since the start. And people are seeing that, you know, through their taste of homeschooling, that homeschooling can really work, like Tim said. But then also, look, we're seeing large numbers of families saying that they prefer homeschooling now and that they have a favorable view of homeschooling. So there's a mind shift happening right now about how education should look like. And we're seeing actual people opt out of the public school system. We see numbers in North Carolina, for example. They already had a large amount of homeschoolers, but this year in particular, the families were switching in such large numbers that they broke or at least shut down temporarily the government website because so many of them were going onto the website and talking and indicating to them that they were intending to homeschool their children this year. And then also in states like Nebraska, they've already reported a 21% increase in the number of enrolled homeschoolers in their state from the same time last year. So people are looking for these options in large numbers, from homeschooling to micro schooling. And then people are reevaluating how school funding should look as well. People are rightly seeing that they're doing a lot of the work. They did a lot of the work for their children in the spring through homeschooling and through this virtual education environment. And they're seeing that the school systems are being reluctant to reopen. And they're rightly understanding that the money is going, and they're noticing that the money is going to the school system, even though the school system isn't providing the same level of services for their child. And I think families are starting to think, you know, if I'm doing most of this work, why shouldn't that money follow my child to wherever they're receiving an education? Why shouldn't I be able to use that funding that already exists for my child to offset the cost of their education? So I think people are understanding that there's no good reason to fund the system or the institution rather than the child directly. And I think this is shining a huge spotlight on that.
Well, thank you both for joining me. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find more on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe.